Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this afternoon is, to my right, Chief Justice Terry Livingston. You can get that one out. And Justice Ann Gardner to my left. I'm Leanne Dofino. And you are the only case we have for oral submission on our 3 o'clock docket. So we are yours for any reasonable length of time. And I understand both sides are ready? Frank? Okay, then if you call the case, we can get started.
Court will now call Paul Gosnell and Kim Gosnell versus Thomas A. Vallon et al. May it please the court, Mr. Jeffrey Crouch will argue for the appellant. Mr. Frank Gilstrap will argue for the appellate.
You go by Jeff or Jeffrey or what? Okay, well, you...
Mostly Jeff. That's what my mom calls
me. All right. Then, Jeff, you're up.
May it please the court, counsel. This appeal is about intent. Webster defines intent as an aim or a purpose. Webster also defines intent as the state of mind with which an act is done. Now, as human beings, we're not mind readers. We can't get into someone else's head to figure out what they intended. The only thing that we have to go on...
We've got too much feedback here. You can keep speaking if you want to, or you can wait, whichever you prefer.
It's up to the court. I'm fine either way. If you'd like to wait until it's distracting, that's fine. If you want me to continue, I'm fine to do that.
Let's wait so it doesn't distract from your argument. Is still. This is a man of many talents. Working, and if we have a problem, we'll just turn it off.
Fair enough.
Okay. Thank you, Embry.
As I was saying, we're here today to try to determine intent, and we'll talk about why here in a moment. But the key thing to remember about intent is because we're not mind readers, we have to go by what people say and do, or by what they don't say or don't do, as in this case. That's why we're here today, using the record before us to determine what the party's intent was, specifically what the appellee's intent was in connection with the motion to dismiss. Now, this case arises out of the trial court's grant of the motion to dismiss that the appellees filed in this case. This case itself arises out of facts that are somewhat straightforward, and for purposes of this appeal, there are no facts that are really in dispute. All of the essentially relevant facts for purposes of this appeal are undisputed. But basically, to give the court a flavor of the case, my clients, the Gosnells, are...
Well, the standard, what we're looking at is what? An intent to waive or enough litigation that it was a de facto waiver, or what are we looking at here?
Both, Your Honor. We are looking indeed at the intent to waive the right to seek dismissal under the Section 150.002 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, the Certificate of Merit statute. What the case law says, and we'll talk about that in a moment, is that if the defendant sufficiently invokes the litigation process, that can be construed as a waiver of the right to seek dismissal under Section 150.002. So the task for the court today and for the task for me is to help you understand why what they did in this case prior to filing the motion to dismiss was indeed a substantial invocation of the judicial process, such that they waived their right to seek dismissal because of a variety of factors that we'll go through here as we get to the actual facts of the case.
The suit was filed in 2011, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And they answered in 2013.
Correct.
And then this thing rocked along with a jury trial setting until February 23rd, 2015, right?
Correct, Your Honor. And I think you may be referencing the handout that I provided to the court and opposing counsel before we got started. Let me just highlight a couple things. You've already mentioned a few of them. The answer was filed in May of 2013 by the appellees. Of note in that answer, it was a general denial, but of note was the fact that they affirmatively sought an award of attorney's fees. The next significant thing to happen, at least from my perspective in highlighting for the court, is that in September, just a few months later, in September of 2013, the parties engaged in a mediation. The parties hadn't been engaged in settlement discussions from the outset of this case. That's why there was a fairly substantial gap between the time the suit was filed and the time the defendants actually answered, because these facts obviously aren't in the record. But there was really no dispute as to the fact that this product that the appellees applied failed. And so the discussions centered around how are we going to handle that? What does the damage look like? So there was a mediation in September 2013. When that was unsuccessful in November of 2013, the appellees responded to the request for disclosure that I served on them. And notable in that, Your Honors, was that they designated two non-party retained experts, one of whom to talk about the technical and the other of whom to talk about the chemical aspects of the soils that were at issue in this case. This case involved the injection of a chemical into the soil and the resulting damage that that created. So they designated experts to talk about that fact.
When was that?
That was done in November of 2013, about 6 months after they filed their answer in the case. Then later in November of 2013, the appellees filed a motion for leave to designate responsible third parties. One of the theories of recovery we asserted in the case was a products liability claim against the manufacturer of the Condor product that was injected into the soil. The appellees sought leave in their motion in November of 2013 to designate the manufacturer of the chemical that was injected as a responsible third party. The case rocked along, as you see from the timeline, through 2014. There was written discovery that was done. There were some amendments that were made to appellee's answers. The parties provided the trial court, with scheduling orders to push the deadlines to manage the case properly. And then towards the end of 2014, the appellees actually then served the Gosnells with written discovery, and they served them with all varieties of discovery. They served admissions, they served interrogatories, they served requests for production. And significantly, both liability and damage was addressed in those discovery requests. Then in December of 2014, they amended their response to the request for disclosure, and they identified as a second potential responsible third party the builder of the Gosnells' home, Shattuck Development. And then in connection with that, and on the same day, and on December 22nd of 2014, they filed a second motion for leave to designate Shattuck as a responsible third party, very similar to the one that they filed back in November of 2013. And then shortly thereafter was the mediation that the parties attended. It was done as the result of an agreed scheduling order the parties submitted that provided for a mediation to occur. So there was a court-ordered mediation. The court-ordered mediation happened. There was no settlement. That was reported to the court. And 2 days later is when the appellees finally filed the motion to dismiss that we're here about today, that the trial court granted. So that's kind of how the timeline worked and some of the significant highlights of the facts. But essentially, those facts are undisputed. So I didn't really feel the need to file any sort of a reply brief, because not only are the facts undisputed, but the law is fairly well undisputed. There's a relatively small set of cases that I think apply here that we'll talk about here in a moment, and the statute says what it says. It's pretty straightforward. So I didn't want to burden the court with a reply brief when we're really just talking about the facts of these cases.
And during this time, the appellants were also sending out affirmative requests for discovery. Is that not true?
That's true, Your Honor.
Okay.
What I tried to do in the facts before you is to highlight the appellee's actions,
okay.
And obviously those were done in response in the discovery context to requests that the appellants served on the appellees.
Well, don't we have a lot of the cases probably that you just referenced that are in y'all's briefs? There's several examples regarding mediation not being a substantial invocation of the litigation process.
Well, there's references to that, Judge, but there's also there's suggestion in the case law that is actually a significant factor. And I would submit to the court that especially in this case where it was a court-ordered mediation as the result of a scheduling order that the parties both submitted to the court,
mm-hmm.
I think that is significant here. And in fact, in the Murphy case, that was a factor in that case, as Justice Gardner may recall from being on that panel. Mediation was something that the court in that case pointed to as a factor that the court considered in ultimately deciding to find that substantial invocation had occurred in that case. And it also applies in other contexts as well. Arbitration is another thing that we've cited in our briefing and cases to support it, including a case out of this court, the Oak Partners case, where the court pointed to factors such as that as evidence of conduct that a party may engage in that is substantially in, of invocation, is a substantial invocation of the appellate process. What I'd like to do is there's a relatively few number of cases that I think really apply, and I'd like to start by highlighting those. The first that I will start with is the Crosstex case. The Crosstex case is a case out of the Texas Supreme Court in 2014 that is probably the most recent substantial discussion of this issue. And before I do that, though, I'd like to bring to the court's attention, we said this in our brief, but I'll highlight it here as well, that the legislature, when it enacted this statute, 150.002, did so for a specific intent and purpose, and that was to, quote, to deter meritless claims and bring them quickly to an end. And that's right out of the Texas Supreme Court's decision in the CTL Thompson, Texas case. And what the court was referring to there is the fact that the legislature developed this statute as a very quick litmus test for defendants such as appellees to use not only to determine whether the claims have merit by virtue of the affidavit that should be filed with the statute, and if it's not or if it's insufficient, to give the defendants, the appellees in this case, a very quick, very painless, very inexpensive way to dispose of that case. And so it's against that backdrop where we start talking about the case law and the substantial invocation and the waiver situation. It's in light of the purpose of the statute, which is to bring these kinds of issues to a head at the very front end of the case rather than 2 or 3 years down the road as in our situation.
But we're here because your clients didn't file their certificate of merit, which would have given the appellees an opportunity to look at their case.
That's exactly true, Your Honor. However, in this situation, the appellees knew exactly what the case was about. We had substantial pre-suit discussions between the parties about what happened. There was no uncertainty from the appellee's standpoint as to what happened. That's why they hired experts and designated them so quickly in this case, because they knew there was merit to the case. Now, were the Gosnells wrong in not filing that? Yes, and I'll take full blame for that. However, this is not a situation where the appellees were struggling to understand what the case was about. They knew exactly what the case was about. They hired experts that dealt exactly with the kinds of facts and issues that they knew were going to come up in this case, and they did that within months of filing an answer. But yet, for some reason, waited several years down the road, or at least a year and a half down the road, before they sought to avail themselves of this quick, easy remedy. Had they filed this motion at the outset of this case, that things would have been very different. I'll agree with you with that, Your Honor. And whether or not we would have been able to preserve all of the case is an open question. But we certainly would have been able to preserve some of the case by virtue of dismissal and refiling, because we had certain claims that weren't susceptible to limitations at the time. And it's exactly that kind of problem that focuses the attention on the waiver issue, because the courts have recognized that in a situation like that where you have a right that you sit on, and more importantly, that when you have a right but you take actions that are inconsistent with that right, and you wait a long period of time, there are a number of factors that the courts rely upon, including those where the courts say, yes, you had that right, but you should have asserted it sooner, and more importantly, you shouldn't have taken the actions that you did that demonstrated that you intended to forego that opportunity. In the Crosstex case, the court confirmed that. This court kind of stepped out on a limb, so to speak, when they first decided that this was actually even something that was available to the appellants in these kinds of situations, i.e., that you could actually waive the protections of the statute. The court made that determination. The court in the Murphy case made that determination. Crosstex confirmed that, and Crosstex also confirmed this court's determination that waiver is based on a substantial invocation of the judicial process. So what you see is Crosstex isn't really changing the analysis. Crosstex is actually confirming the analysis that this court set forth in Murphy, and instead took the facts before it after it had confirmed that that was the proper procedural posture and the proper procedural approach to take, and evaluated the facts before it in that case to make the determination that in that situation there was no waiver. Now, that was contrasted with the Murphy case. The Murphy case actually had more things, more factors in play than the Crosstex case did, which is why the Murphy court, this court, decided that in that situation waiver was appropriate. There was substantial invocation of the judicial process. And as we've argued in our brief, this case that we're here on today, the Gosnells case, is factually very similar, not identical, but factually very similar to the Murphy case. And for the reasons that I've set forth in my brief, and I'll highlight a couple of them, as with the Murphy case, the Gosnells here sought affirmative relief from the trial court. The appellees sought affirmative relief in the trial court because they filed motions for leave to designate third parties. Now, I expect you'll hear from the appellees counsel that, Murphy involves summary judgment motions. Other cases have involved summary judgment motions. That's the kind of affirmative relief that we're talking about. The Murphy case doesn't say that, nor does any other case. It simply talks about seeking affirmative relief. We have that in this case. The appellees did that here. They filed motions for leave to designate third parties. They asked the court for attorney's fees. They asked the court for scheduling orders. They asked the court to send us to mediation. So there were things that were affirmatively done by the appellees that are akin to the kinds of things that we see in these cases.
Any questions? Do you have any questions? Thank you. Brian?
I agree that that Crosstex was an important case. Certainly it did say that waiver is applicable to these kinds of cases and indeed to any other kind of case in which which involves a mandatory statutory duty, such as here the duty to file the certificate of merit in a suit against an engineer. But what Murphy did was, having said that, it denied. It said that there was no waiver, and in so doing, it addressed a number of arguments that are often found in the case law and said that they are not applicable here. If you don't do anything else, and I know you will do more, read page 394 of Murphy. It's very short, and that's where the law is today. I want to talk about, and I think it will help, because the way the law has developed in this area, you know, they say that their case is like Murphy against Gutierrez, and we say, no, our case is like Crosstex. And they say, no, we're comparing apples against oranges, and there's no standard there. That's because the Supreme Court in Perry against Cull said it's a totality of circumstances, and you got to consider all the factors, and we know it's hard, but you got to do it. That makes principled decision-making very hard. But in light of Crosstex, I suggest that it's somewhat easier. And I want to talk about the factors involved. First of all, time. The first question from the court involved time. And when you read their brief, they say, gosh, we waited 3.5 years, kind of like Murphy against Gutierrez. But in fact, the delay here was only 1 year and 7 months, 19 months. What happened during that time? We were trying to settle the case. Certainly we can't be penalized for that.
Is that in the record?
What's that? Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, if you look at the reporter's record, which is the record of the argument mm-hmm. on the motion to dismiss, both sides talk about their efforts to settle the case.
So that's undisputed there.
Yes, that's right. They were trying to settle the case. That's why they waited. We waited a year and a half to file an answer. It's not in the record, but this is a foundation case. And in these kind, and a lot of the cases are foundation cases when you look at them. In these kinds of cases, you're often trying to fix the problem. That's what foundation companies, especially people like Lee Engineering that have been in business for a long time, try to do. But certainly it wasn't a long period of time. And when you look at that, the last word from the Supreme Court on time is in Jernigan against Langley, a case that was decided in 03 involving not the certificate of merit, but the requirement to file an expert witness report in a medical liability case. And there the Supreme Court says that the mere fact that a defendant waits to file a motion for dismissal is insufficient to establish waiver unless the defendant's silence or inaction shows an intent to yield the right to dismissal. I'm not sure when the silence or inaction would show an intent to waive the right of dismissal, but it's certainly not present in this case. And I suspect, I would suggest, that in Murphy against Gutierrez, which Judge Justice Meyer wrote, and he said, well, excessive time in that case, 3.5 years, is one of the factors that we can consider. I don't think that that's strictly in accord with Jernigan. The delay itself has to evidence an intent to waive. The mere fact that we sit here and wait 10 years to file our motion to dismiss doesn't trigger anything. We're not taking affirmative action. Okay, so time,
I think,
excuse
me, Mr. Gilstrap, excuse me. So where were you counting from on your 19 months as opposed to the 3.5 years from date of filing?
It was filed in September 11th.
Okay.
We didn't file our answer until May 31st of 2013.
Okay.
And look at the report, clerk's record. Petition this date, next thing that happens is our answer on May 31st of 2013. Now, we engaged in discovery. I want to look at what counsel says in his brief because first of all, it's well written and it's an excellent job of making a mountain out of a molehill. Because I mean, look here, I'm going to deconstruct this one statement. On November 1st, we responded to the request for disclosure. Well, we had to. In there, we repeated our denials and defenses in our First Amendment answer. Well, in the response to the request for disclosure, you're supposed to set forth the defenses. And we designated non-party experts. Well, in the request for disclosure response, you've got to designate your experts if you have them. What are we supposed to do? Keep them hidden? That's different from what the rule requires. We did nothing but simply what the rule required. Then, in response to their discovery, we produced several hundred pages of documents. Well, so we did. We had to. What are we supposed to do? Withhold the documents they asked for? Finally, we did submit our own requests for admissions, interrogatories, and requests for production, which encompass both liability and damage. Well, are we supposed to not ask about those things? And they responded. That's all that the record shows. Well, let's look at the standard for discovery in Crosstex. The Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, again, on page 394. The rules encourage liberal discovery practice. Information may sustain a case or it may lead to an end of litigation, but in either case, it's the lifeblood of the process. Here, Crosstex claims it exchanged 11,000 pages of written discovery pursuant to the docket control order and that this evidence is waiver. But they cite Jernigan, quite simply, attempting to learn more about the case in which one is a party does not demonstrate an intent to waive the right to move for dismissal. Now, I guess that leaves open the possibility that somehow the discovery could be so excessive that it's a waiver. That's certainly what the court said in Murphy, but the discovery in that case was far more extensive than in this case, and I'm not sure that discovery after Crosstex can even be considered.
Well, Frank, let me ask you this. If part of the reason for filing the affidavit is to cut out the expense of unnecessary litigation, then isn't that also part of the reason for requiring the other side to invoke that rule, well, been the purpose in part, at least,
to cut... That logic there, and that logic is set forth in Murphy against Gutierrez. I can see that. But the legislature, in other cases, has put a time limit on when you can file your objection. And there's no time limit here. Moreover, as was pointed out earlier, sometimes it's not an instantaneous process. Sometimes you have to figure out what the opposing side's case is before you can find out whether you can conclude whether a certificate of merit is even required in the first place. In light of that, I don't think that you can simply say that, well, it's best the system works best if you do it promptly, but if you don't do it promptly, somehow you waive your right. I don't think the court can get there. I don't think the court should get there under that argument. What about filing our answer? They make a big deal of this. They say we file specific denials, verified denials, affirmative defenses. We even designated a responsible third party. Well, that's what you're supposed to do in your answer. We didn't sue the responsible third party in a third party action. We simply put what was in the answer, what was required to be in the answer. In Crosstex, here's what the Supreme Court says. Filing an answer is similarly inconsequential. We should not penalize parties or their attorneys for acting out of an abundance of caution and protecting the interest by filing an answer. We also did file a perfunctory, our predecessor filed a perfunctory plea for attorney's fees at the end of the answers. Attorneys often do that. I don't, but attorneys often do. And I don't think an attorney should be penalized for that. What are we talking about when they say affirmative relief? They say that we sought affirmative relief by seeking and obtaining trial continuances and seeking to designate multiple responsible third parties. Well, what does Crosstex say about that? They say in that case, the defendant joined a motion for continuance, engaged in discovery under a docket control order, and entered into a Rule 11 agreement. Though that is some support for the waiver argument, it falls far short of clearly demonstrating an intent to waive the right to dismiss under subsection 150. Well, finally, what about the mediation? Counsel is incorrect. There were two mediations, one before we got in the ballgame. And there was an immediate mediation early on. There was a subsequent mediation that was in the discovery control order. What about mediation? Well, I believe I have something on that. Oh yeah, here's what happened in Murphy. And this, I think, was the key element in Murphy. We conclude that Gutierrez's participation in court-ordered mediation after having sought and achieved partial summary judgment in this case is a factor in convincing that he intended to relinquish his right to pursue dismissal. I can see that. I can see if you get a partial summary judgment, court, judge, now we want you to make a mediate. They're going to settle because we've got them at an advantage. That's one thing. Certainly, there can't be any adverse consequence from the first mediation in this case. I mean, we're supposed to try to settle these cases. Mediation is favored. I think the court would embark on down the wrong road if it actually were to say that mediation in this case somehow amounted to a waiver. In summary, this is an ordinary case. It's no different from scores of other cases in which the court has said that there is no waiver. And I want you to be mindful of what's going on here. because we have this difficult standard, this case-by-case basis standard, you don't have a standard, but the message is clear that waiver should be rare and difficult. It should occur in only a few cases. And why? Because every time you hand down a case in which you say these factors lead to waiver, that emboldens scores of other litigants to come in and say, well, there's waiver in our case too. That's what's happened with Murphy. But Murphy can so easily be distinguished. There's nothing about this case that jumps out at you. Why on earth would you say that waiver has occurred in this case?
Because you ran up their attorney's fees from 2011 until 2015.
Well,
and ran up your own client's attorney's fees, even though you weren't in the case yet. But
well, there's I don't think that's ever been raised in a case, first of all, and secondly, there's no evidence here. If that were the case, then there's no evidence of attorney's fees.
Well, okay, but you pointed out that the purpose of this statute is to prevent the expense of baseless litigation. And if the purpose is to prevent the expense, then it seems counterintuitive that litigation that goes on for about 4 years
in this case, 19 months. Yeah, you know.
Well,
that's in fact. Although that, you know, certainly I don't think we should be penalized for not filing an answer. I mean, I think the clock needs to start then when we filed our answer. If you're talking about how long it is, but in that case, under that view, every case in which there is a delay is going to amount to a waiver because the parties expended unnecessary attorney's fees. And moreover, it's not necessarily a quick process. As has been pointed out, sometimes it takes a while to tee it up. Sometimes it takes a while to see exactly what their claim is. You need discovery for that, and then file the motion to dismiss. So while it seems plausible that you can make that argument, I think that there are just too many practical difficulties for this court to do what no other court has done, which is to come in and say, well, you caused attorney's fees to be run up, therefore there was a waiver.
Well, that wasn't exactly what I said.
What's that?
I said that wasn't exactly what I said.
Well, I'll try to get it right if you want to ask it again. I'm sorry.
We're talking about waiver here and indications of waiver, and this is the very nature of its lawsuit, it seems to me, would indicate the need for an affidavit at the very beginning.
We don't know. There were a number of causes of action that were alleged. And again, we don't know how broad their claim is. So we have to do some discovery before we can file it. But again, I think if the court went down that road, it would be stepping out because no other court has.
Well, do you want us to say that hiding behind the law until statutes of limitations have run, which is something else that really jumps out here?
Well, I don't think there's any allegation. Wait a minute. I mean, the case was dismissed. I believe it's told up until the time the case is dismissed. I mean,
well, not if the cause of action hadn't been filed, is it?
What's that?
Never mind. I don't want to.
But I mean, there's no evidence here of that anybody lost anything through the statute of limitations.
Okay.
Thank you again for your time.
Thanks. Jeff?
I'll start my rebuttal, Your Honors, by just categorically refuting what Mr. Gilstrap just said. Not only did they not argue that at the trial court in support of the motion to dismiss. In fact, they argued exactly the opposite, that the statute is mandatory, it requires an affidavit when the original complaint is filed, and if it's not filed with the original complaint, the case must be dismissed, period, end of discussion.
That's not what you heard from counsel today, and it's not what the statute, but it is what the statute says. The statute's very clear. If you don't file your affidavit when you file your complaint, absent waiver, you're done. Now, you heard counsel say lots of things up here that I want to talk about. The first is he keeps telling you we only did what we were supposed to do. Well, we were not supposed to answer discovery, produce documents, answer requests for disclosure. The simple answer to that is no. What you were supposed to do is to file your motion to dismiss when this lawsuit was filed. When you were served with this lawsuit, the motion to dismiss should have been the very next thing to happen. And in fact, if you look at the statute even contemplates that. Section 150.002D mandates, or excuse me, provides the defendants with an excuse from filing an answer until 30 days after the filing a certificate of merit. So not only does the statute not support what Mr. Gilstrap said, it actually is exactly the opposite. They don't even have to do anything in the case until there's an affidavit filed. They can either not file an answer at all and do nothing, or they can immediately seek to dismiss the case, which is what all of the cases that have hesitated to find waiver say. Crosstex, O'Connor, Ustinic, Cimarron, all of those cases say you should have done it at the beginning. You didn't, the affidavit should have been filed at the beginning. It wasn't filed. It can't be cured. You were right to file your motion, and you didn't waive it. Now, a lot of those cases are distinguishable from this case, from the Murphy case, and from this case. But the fact remains that they didn't do what they were supposed to do. They were supposed to file the motion, and that's exactly why we're here today, because they engaged substantially in the litigation process. They did not file their motion until after they had sought affirmative relief, gone to two mediations, answered and propounded discovery, produced documents in the case, sought to deflect their liability onto third parties that weren't before the court. They hired experts at the very early portion of this case because they knew exactly what this case was about. They didn't need time to take depositions or serve discovery or do whatever it is they thought they needed to do to learn about the case before they filed their motion to dismiss. The statute gave them that right from the moment this suit was filed, and they simply didn't avail themselves of that right. Now, I want to talk a little bit about Crosstex, because you would think from the argument that you heard from Mr. Gilstrap that Crosstex changed the analysis, and that's not true. Crosstex does have language about inconsequential, and this really doesn't apply, and that shouldn't really apply, but the fact of the matter is, if you look at page 395 of Crosstex, the Crosstex says that the factors, while in its view, didn't justify waiver, the court itself said that they provided some support of waiver. It just was, in that court's view, not enough to support waiver. So despite Mr. Gilstrap's attempt to characterize Crosstex as changing the landscape or eliminating some of these factors that this court in Murphy found applicable and that other courts have found applicable, it analyzed the same factors. It just made a different decision. And we would submit to the court that Justice Dofano's point about attorney's fees is right on. It's spot on. That's exactly why this statute exists, and it's exactly why defendants should be filing motions at the beginning of this case before anything else happens. Because if they don't, not only does it prejudice potentially the claimants in the case, because they can do things like dismissal without prejudice to fix that problem that when that problem pops up. But by waiting and not doing that, you're creating a situation where if you're 2 years, whether it's 18 months, 24 months, 3.5 years, whatever it is, you may be in a situation where limitations preclude you from simply dismissing and refiling to cure. But not only that, it does require the parties to incur attorney's fees, and there is evidence in the record of that. If you look at the record at page 171, they amended their disclosure responses to allege that they had incurred attorney's fees. And that attorney's fees, if you look in the record, that attorney's fees number went up and up and up. It had started at $5,000. I think it went to $10,000. And ultimately, I think it ended up at $20,000. So there is evidence in the record to suggest exactly what you said, Justice Dofano. It did require the expenditure of attorney's fees by the appellees that they simply would not have had to incur had they followed the intent and the purpose of this statute. We're not just talking about appellee's intent here. We're talking about the legislature's intent. The legislature intended for appellees like this to very quickly and very inexpensively get rid of meritless cases. That's why that statute was written that way. That's why they should have filed their motion at the beginning of the case before anything else happened. And that's why, because they didn't and because they substantially invoked the litigation process, that they waived the right to do so. And we would ask the court to find that on the facts of this case and in light of the precedents of this and other courts to make the determination that there was waiver of the motion to dismiss. And we would ask the court to remand this case back to the trial court to reverse its decision and remand it back for a trial on the merits.
I had a question, yeah. In your case here today, there was no filing of a motion for partial summary judgment or summary judgment?
There was not, Your Honor. Okay. And I'll tell you why I think the reason for that is. I think the reason that certainly there wasn't on our part, because I didn't think there was any way that the court would grant it. And I only suspect that the appellees felt the same way. This was not the kind of case, in my view, that was going to get summary judgment granted.
Right.
But important, though, to note is the case law doesn't talk about summary judgment motions as a factor or a prerequisite for a waiver to apply. What it talks about is seeking affirmative relief. Now, obviously, a motion for summary judgment is probably the most drastic affirmative relief as an appellee that you can ask for, but the cases don't limit to that. And in fact, in our case and in other cases, there were requests for affirmative relief. Sometimes it was a scheduling order. Sometimes it was a cross-claim or a third-party complaint. In our situation, it was a request for designation of third parties, responsible third parties. In and of itself, it doesn't sound like a lot, but when you think about what it was that they were doing, it's significant in light of the statute. Because what were they doing? They were giving merit to the meritless claims they said existed by virtue of the statute, or that the statute was designed to eliminate. So they clearly thought there were merit in the claims, and then just poof, at the end of the day, 30 days before we have a jury trial, 2.5 years later, they finally decide that they want to avail themselves of the statutory ability to dismiss this case that they had when it was first filed, and before it was there ever even answered. When they were served, they could have filed that motion, and they didn't. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your argument today. A lot of questions here. Case is submitted. You're free to go about your business. Nobody for you to sit around and watch, so we're going to be shutting down the courthouse. This court will be adjourned. And